Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We're all looking to make more sustainable choices, but making your own shoes out of natural materials could pose a few challenges. The twigs and leaves in your yard aren't exactly comfortable. And while mud does perfectly contour the feet, it doesn't score high on the durability front. But thanks to Allbirds, you can skip all the backyard experimentation. At the Allbirds Innovation Lab, they're doing all the sciencey stuff like research and testing to create shoes from natural, sustainable materials. And their innovative processes mean using less of the bad stuff and more of the good, while making shoes unlike any other. Like the Plant Pacer, made with 100% plastic-free plant leather. The Tree Dasher, a running shoe made from eucalyptus tree fiber. And from sugarcane, they've made the Superlight, their lightest shoe ever by weight and carbon footprint. It's not rocket science, it's shoe science. Allbirds is making shoes better than natural. They're supernatural. Find your perfect pair at Allbirds.com today. That's Allbirds.com.
Welcome to Upfront on Football Ramble Presents. I'm Flo Lloyd-Hughes.
I'm Chloe Morgan.
And I'm Rachel O'Sullivan.
Today we're taking a special look at the monumental day for US women's football as the national team finally settled their equal pay lawsuit against the US Soccer Federation. But is it really the big win it's been reported as? We speak to Rachel Backman from the Wall Street Journal to find out more.
So US Soccer has said it will refuse to sign and ratify either of those agreements if they don't equalize pay going forward. So essentially, what this settlement relies on is not only the finalizing of the women's collective bargaining agreement, but also the US men's teams.
Plus, we preview Man City and Chelsea's battle in the Conti Cup final this Saturday. It was a fun weekend of Vitality Women's FA Cup fifth round action. Rachel, you were at the crazy game that finished with absolute scenes. I think that clip that someone shared, I don't know if it was the video that you shared, but there was a video that I kept seeing on my timeline that's definitely gone viral of that header in the last minute of extra time.
So there was ours and there was someone else's. Ian Wright shared ours, no big deal. but I think it was the other person's who got shared by Vitality Cup. I had the video out because I basically wanted to film, you know, Ipswich celebrating. It was the last minute of extra time. So I wanted to film them celebrating the win and the crowd and stuff.
Yeah.
And up pops Rendell to just head home. Goalkeeper heads home in the final minute, like last kick of the game. And I managed to capture that. So that was pretty cool. Probably the most exciting part of that game because they kept the goals till very, very late. But they ended up, Ipswich ended up winning it on penalties. So it got quite exciting right towards the end.
I was going to say as well, for Ipswich, I mean, like psychologically, for Ipswich to feel like they've almost thrown the game away, having been seconds away from getting through to the next round, to then compose themselves and win the penalty shootout, it's pretty impressive. And goalkeepers, heroes, stars of the show, because not only did a goalkeeper get the equaliser, but then a goalkeeper also was the star in the penalty shootout. So what a day for goalkeepers, eh?
I think my biggest concern actually is that they've raised the bar for goalkeepers.
Expectations are too high now, if anything.
Yeah, I think it's that. I mean, we're also expected to do distribution and, you know, saving goals as well and, you know, all those other things. And now we're expected to score goals in the last dying minutes of a game. So
It's
come on, guys. Yeah, let the rest of us.
The standards
chill
are too high.
It was quite funny because we actually interviewed her on Thursday before the game, and we were just chatting to her about like her career and her excitement for the game and who she looks up to and why she likes them as goalkeepers. And she was saying they've actually she named
Chloe Bloody Morgan.
I was going to say, what an honour.
She was saying they actually got a few assists, which is really cool. And we were like, oh, so maybe on Sunday you can get an assist. And she was like, I've already got one this season. So we jokingly said, oh, you're going to have to do one better. She bloody did.
Wow, she is. Edison who? She is the techers. You were in sunny Sunderland
again
on Sunday. A lot of suns.
Yes.
Finally, you could play that game.
Whoop, whoop. Yes, we did.
State of the pitch was...
not frozen this time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did it rain?
Really good. No, it was sunny.
Oh, nice.
Weird.
It was quite good weather on the weekend, actually.
It was lovely. Yeah. A little bit of wind, a little bit cold. But yeah, I mean, you could almost get a tan on it. It was quite nice. I didn't have too much to do. But I mean, it was a great game. We obviously won the game 1-0. It was a really, really hard fought, tough battle. But we pulled one out of the bag in the second half and went home and celebrated. Yeah, the win after the second travel up there.
And how's the finger?
Fine now, pretty much all recovered.
Oh, great!
A little bit battered and a little bit sort of like knobbly.
Okay,
but otherwise, what are you laughing at?
Nothing. Sorry.
No, it looks fine.
Beautiful.
It looks fine to me.
Very nice.
Well, let's get stuck into the nitty gritty of this week because we're going to get a little bit technical, but we did really want to look into the US Women's National Team's settlement with the US Soccer Federation. And we wanted to kind of go in deep about it and get Chloe's perspective as a player and also kind of look at the long-term impact of it. So we know that ourselves, maybe not the best experts in this, we're obviously all UK-based as well. So in order to kind of get a better perspective on things, we have gone to some of the pros. But it's been a long journey for the US Women's National Team to get here. They filed this lawsuit 6 years ago, but last week they finally settled on that suit and come to an end on it. And perhaps it's just the beginning on some other things as well. But yeah, it's been an interesting thing, shall we say?
Yeah, and we wanted to speak to someone obviously who's been at the heart of the issue, get some real insight. So we chatted to Rachel Backman. She's a sports reporter of the Wall Street Journal. And we wanted to properly understand what this landmark ruling actually means and what needs to happen next.
Well, this battle essentially began decades ago with members of the US women's soccer team being upset with how they were treated by the US Soccer Federation. It advanced about 6 years ago to a formal federal complaint, and then 3 years ago to a lawsuit, which expanded into a class action lawsuit, eventually encompassing about more than 60 women's players. And what the women were alleging was that the U.S. Soccer Federation illegally paid them less than members of the men's national team, and provided unequal, you know, facilities, travel accommodations, etc. So those were the stakes in this lawsuit. What this deal does is the U.S. Soccer Federation has promised to pay the women who sued $24 million to settle all legal claims. $2 million of that is sort of a discrete fund that the women can apply to for sort of post-career projects and goals and furtherance of girls and women's football. But generally, this is back pay for what the women have alleged is unequal pay. So in that measure, this is, one could say this is a victory for the women because they are getting some back pay that they say they were owed. But two, they have said all along that they want to change the pay structure for women going forward. And according to this settlement, and if it does indeed go forward, they have achieved that. And so you have two parts. You have the settlement amount that's going to go to, as I said, 61 players. So it's not only the players who were named in the lawsuit, it's others who joined the class action. And also, you know, the players who follow them, U.S. Soccer has pledged what it says will be equal pay. Now, we haven't seen what that means in practicality, but that, again, the devil's in the details, but if the women have achieved that second objective, that is equal pay going forward, and including World Cup prize money, by the way, I would say that's a pretty profound achievement that will conceivably affect every US women's national team player in the future.
So this is all resting on the US Soccer Federation and the women's players agreeing a collective bargaining agreement. Can you explain what that actually entails?
Yes, well, that is a contingency for the finalization of this settlement. So, and it gets a bit more complicated because, as I mentioned, there's this prospect of equal pay that U.S. Soccer is trying to meet. So U.S. Soccer has said ostensibly that the U.S. women will have to agree to a collective bargaining agreement, which is the ongoing labor agreement between the U.S. women's team and the Federation, the U.S. Soccer Federation, before this deal will be ratified and finalized, before they get any money. So that needs to happen. But separately, U.S. Soccer has also said that it will refuse to ratify any collective bargaining agreement. And here it's important to note that the men's and women's teams have separate players' unions and separate labor agreements or collective bargaining agreements. So U.S. Soccer has said it will refuse to sign and ratify either of those agreements if they don't equalize pay going forward. So essentially, what this settlement relies on is not only the finalizing of the women's collective bargaining agreement, but also the U.S. men's team's collective bargaining agreement. And, you know, taking a step farther back, I think followers of football know that generally in the women's game, many women's players, and this is true in the U.S. as well, tend to get more of their income from their federations than from their clubs, because women's clubs tend to be younger and tend to pay less than, for instance, men's clubs, which in many cases are a century old and pay more, much more mature professional market. So in the U.S., you know, the men's team collective bargaining agreement expired in 2018. This is not a team that's acted with a lot of urgency to update that agreement. And it's generally because most of those players, if not all of those players, make more from their clubs than they do from U.S. Soccer. This is particularly true in recent years when, of course, the U.S. men's team didn't qualify for the last World Cup. So, you know, it made probably less than, definitely less than it would have had it qualified for the Russian World Cup. And so that arguably their income from U.S. soccer is even less important in recent years than it has been in the past. So that's sort of the complex backdrop to this. And it's a very big caveat to the actual execution of this settlement.
Yeah, really interesting to hear from Rachel there, get the insight from the States as well. It's complicated, we will say that, because there's obviously lots of elements on it. There's things that have been backdated to do with World Cup prize money, to do with salary over the last few years. So it is very complicated. But you have to say, short term, it is, and long term, there is a lot of positives to take from this settlement as a whole.
Yeah, it's a step in the right direction. It's been a long, hard fight. You know, it didn't kind of start recently. It's been going on for years and years. So we're definitely moving in the right direction. I mean, I do think it's interesting. We've got a lot of teams around the world now who are already have already moved on to equal pay. So you're kind of looking at that and saying, catch up, US, a little bit, which is weird for a team that's been the guiding light for so long. But yeah, it's about time. It's definitely a step in the right direction. But as you say, it's complex, and I don't think it's quite all over the line and maybe the way it's been reported.
I think it is a significant step forward, but I think there's still so much more that needs to be done. But I think, you know, when you look at the progress of how the claim has been, it was never an easy battle for them, starting out in 2016, and then they had the claim dismissed. And I think, you know, along the way, if anything, it's managed to highlight, you know, some of the inner workings and the inner thoughts of, you know, the US Soccer Federation. I know the former president sort of came out in some of his lawsuits and in sort of response to the lawsuit and said that, you know, there was a claim that the men's players deserved more money because of the strength and skill and things like that. So I think, if anything, the lawsuit has really highlighted the inequalities that exist. And I think now they've actually got the win, which obviously is not as much as they initially expected to get. I think, you know, I think their initial filing was back for $67 million. But again, this money is going to go a long way in recompensating those players for money that they deserve to have. So it is a big win.
Yeah, and Rachel touches on the fact that obviously we know in women's football these international contracts are more valuable for players because this is where they're going to earn the most money. And because the domestic game isn't as developed like it is in the men's game, these are crucial. And that's why this CBA agreement, which is kind of the next stage of this settlement in order for the US team to kind of get that next pay, is relying on the men's team negotiating a CBA, but they don't necessarily have the priority. I mean, without getting too stuck into that yet, I wanted to chat to you, Chloe, about negotiating contracts. Obviously, Rachel and I have absolutely no experience with this when it comes to being a player. I haven't got that much experience anyway when it comes to kind of things in general, work in general, because I'm not signing multi-million dollar contracts. But
one day,
we hope. But yeah, I mean, tell us what it's like when you, I mean, how does it work? Is it, you know, some players will obviously have an agent, but are you given the contract? You have to go away, look at it. Do some players just sign? Is there someone who's put forward as the main spokesperson? And how has it played out for you? And how might it play out for national team?
I think it's a very varied answer because I think it basically does depend on what type of player you are, sort of previous knowledge and experience of contracts, and also the kind of reputation and status that you have as a player and whether you have representation yourself. So for me, when I get the contract through, I mean, we get the same one pretty much every year. It's the standard FA worded contract that the WSL players and the Championship players get. You know, I'll read through the contract, and to be honest, I've read through it so many times this year, and it's never changed. I don't know what I'm expecting to pop up.
You never know; they might put some kind of like small print in there, like
a little dodgy something. Yeah, that I just want to make sure.
Not allowed to do podcasts.
Yeah, it's that.
Chloe has to go to Sunderland every Sunday. You don't want that
for no reason, just to be away from the squad for the week. But yeah, I think the kind of lawyer head in me is very much, I'll always go through the contract with a fine tooth comb myself. And obviously I've got an agent, Jo, who's amazing. And I'll sort of speak to her and say, you know, I'm not too happy with this or what's the situation on this. And then she'll have the negotiations on my behalf with someone, the GM, the general manager of the club, who will sort of come back and say, yeah, we can move on this or no, we can't. But it does depend on your status as a player. If you're sort of, you know, just coming into the Championship, or you're not one of the more well-known players in the WSL, your bargaining position is obviously a lot lesser. If you're, you know, Miedemar, if you're, you know, Beth Mead, you're, you know, one of the big, you know, top names, I think you're probably in a much better bargaining position. But I think that's the issue, I think, with the Championship and the WSL at the moment, is that, you know, some of those players aren't represented, and also some of the players in those leagues are very young. So what you're starting to see, I mean, I've had a couple of the sort of younger players in my team come to me for sort of contract advice, and, you know, they're starting to engage agents now. But, you know, there's also a fear as well that, you know, you're going to get some agents who aren't particularly, you know, they don't have the best morals, and they can take advantage of a situation where people aren't, you know, they're not used to reading contracts. You've got younger players who've not seen a contract before. They don't know their rights. They don't know what they're entitled to. So it's definitely an area that's progressing, but one that's sort of a bit fraught with danger at the moment.
And what was so powerful about this lawsuit is that, you know, so many players came together because they knew that there was going to be, you know, strength in numbers. Mm-hmm. Has there ever been a case where you've kind of come together as a group, and obviously we saw that with Birmingham City over the last year or so, where they realised they needed to come together to take a stand in order to improve things? Has there ever been a moment where you've been in a squad and you've come together and you've said, right, this isn't working for us, we're all not happy about X, Y, Z, you know, let's come together and take that forward as a complaint or whatever? And, you know, how hard is that to do as well?
It's very hard. I think if I use my experiences at Spurs, you know, when I left Spurs, I was quite vocal. I sent out a tweet to say how unhappy I was about the conditions, the treatment that we'd been given, you know, at Spurs at the time. There were instances where we weren't allowed to use the men's car park. There were instances where we were using a, you know, a gym that didn't have the correct facilities and we were sharing it with the public, and, you know, where we weren't allowed to use the same pitches as the men and things like that. And they were all things that, you know, behind the scenes, we were really unhappy about as players. But it's very hard to stick your head above the parapet if you're the only one who will do that, because, you know, you can appreciate, especially as, you know, as younger players or players who are getting game time, you're rocking the boat if you go and speak out publicly against these things. So often that you find the one or two players might feel comfortable doing that, potentially older players, or players who are coming to the end of their playing careers who aren't too fussed about the implications. But for younger players, it's quite hard to speak out and get a sort of collective agreement amongst players, which is why I was so sort of proud and impressed with what Birmingham City had done and written that letter to say, do you know what, we're all in this together. Things need to change, because you can't sack an entire squad.
We saw that as well, because, you know, obviously with the US team, they're so well known. They've been so successful still incredible that they came together in the numbers they did. But you've seen other teams who maybe don't hold that same kind of power with their federation actually standing up and saying, this is unacceptable. Ireland did it. They threatened to boycott a game because they were having to, they weren't getting paid. They had to share tracksuits with some of the younger teams. There was reports of them having to change in the airport so that the under 18s or the under 19s could get the tracksuit, you know, stuff like that. So what's incredible is when you see those teams who maybe don't have the same power or notoriety at the time, being able to stand up together and kind of say enough is enough. Because when we talk about equality, we're not talking about money all the time. And that's mm-hmm. something that always gets thrown in our face is you don't deserve to be paid the same amount as the men. But, you know, it's about facilities, it's about opportunities. And that's where the equality needs to be across the board.
Yeah, and I think what's been important in this case is that, you know, players like Megan Rapinoe have always been quite vocal in saying this is very much not just about us, although we're the names in the filing. We know that this is about a legacy that we leave behind for US women's national team players to come after us, which I think is fantastic. And I think, you know, that's the most important thing, because a lot of those players have made their money, you know, and they need to think about the future and the generations to come. I think the one critical eye that I shine on this is that because of the situation in the States with the NWSL and with the way that contracts work over there, is that the domestic game is still so weak that there's only a finite number of women that are ever going to benefit from these new contracts or this payout. And you've still got players, although the new CBA with the NWSL players is fantastic, I think the minimum salary is now going to be $35,000, a 60% lift. You've still got so many women's footballers in that country who are literally earning the bare bones. And the same could be said in England, like so many players who are not earning, you know, barely enough to live. And there's a finite window of players who are ever going to make the most in the international kind of contract situation. So you want to see that kind of long-term vision where you say, right, now you've got US soccer at the table, how can you make an impact in the NWSL as well? Because I can't see that beyond this, about the US being held as the prime example and a brilliant example of national federations paying players what they deserve and for what they've achieved. But at the same time, like, there's still that separation for the domestic game. And, you know, that is going to encourage more federations to step up. I'm sure of it. I'm sure it's going to have a wider impact. And Rachel's going to touch on that as well. But I just want to see more in that domestic game. And I know people probably say, oh, you're being overcritical. Like, you know, this is great. And you need to kind of take a moment to appreciate that. But I do think at the same time, like, you want more. And you also need to have that reality that so few people are ever going to get the opportunity to play for their national team. And it shouldn't be that only playing for your national team is how you make enough money. Everyone should be able to be a footballer and earn enough money.
I don't think you can underestimate the impact that improving or increasing the sort of average wage across the league will have. So I think even obviously in the WSL, some of the leagues or some of the wages that you see are in the sort of, you know, the teens, the low 20s. And, you know, if you want to get the best out of a player, you know, paying them the absolute bare minimum, especially for clubs or, you know, especially in London, where obviously the price of living is now going up and petrol and all those other expenses and national insurance and whatever. But also being an athlete is a very expensive job. I mean, you do need to normally have a car, you need to have insurance, you need to be buying the right foods, good food in every week. So, you know, you can't be paying people the bare minimum, because, you know, otherwise you're going to be in a situation where you've got players who are more worried about whether they can pay the rent and pay the bills than how they're performing on the field. And I think that's such a brilliant point, that, you know, you can't just focus on, yes, this award, this settlement is fantastic for the women's national team, but at the same time, there needs to be more focus on the domestic league, because I think that is obviously what's going to grow the talent to get into the US
yeah, exactly.
Team in the first place.
I think it's always going to be difficult as well, because of the way that the US league is run, that, you know, players are contracted to the federation, so there's always that kind of weird situation. Whereas here, it's you've got your club salary and you've got your international federation salary, and it's like the two kind of complement each other and add to each other. Mm-hmm. Whereas the contract situation there is kind of almost holding back that development, because it's like, well, it's almost like the national federation is always going to trump. It's always going to be the most important, and they're also paying your wages. So it's like you don't see that development filter down. But I don't want to obviously get bogged down in that too much. But I mean, we were talking, Rachel, before we recorded the show about prize money and how, you know, another bigger picture of this is making sure that it filters down, because obviously for the US team, it's already quite a wealthy nation. It's already quite a prosperous women's football program. They've obviously won a lot. And a lot of this lawsuit was tied up in the lack of prize money as well of winning the World Cup, and how, you know, the men's team didn't even qualify for the 2018 World Cup, and the women's team should have received the bonuses for winning the tournament. So for me, when I see improvements in prize money, it has to be an increase in the prize pot. And it's the same with the FA Cup, it's the same with a lot of these tournaments. It has to be an increase in the prize pot, because 9 times out of 10, the people that are going to win the competition are already the rich. And the rich are only going to get richer if you keep that end figure as the big one and it doesn't filter down. So it's that distribution which is so huge. But I mean, do you guys think that this will also have an influence on FIFA coming ahead to the next World Cup next year and thinking, right, well, we're going to look at increasing things as well? I mean, I think they already have as well for the next World Cup. I think they already have announced what it's going to be for 2023, but looking further ahead.
Yeah, I should hope so, because, I mean, this is a conversation and a narrative that's been going on for a long time, but this is probably one of the loudest voices in women's football, not only speaking and pushing it forward, but in essence winning this landmark deal. So it should absolutely influence future discussions around prize money. And we talked about it being, yeah, as you said, across the board, not just increasing it for the winners, because, you know, FIFA expanding the tournament, just adding more teams, isn't necessarily going to grow the game. It's got to be about investing in those teams so that those teams can go on to invest in football in their own country. Just kind of throwing them into a tournament to be absolutely trounced potentially isn't actually going to necessarily help the growth of the game in that country. So I think definitely, I do think this is going to help that conversation. I do think it's going to help other clubs, other countries feel strong and powerful enough to speak up and say, this needs to be better. And yeah, I think looking at that prize money and how it's spread across all the teams that qualify is more important, I think, than just the ultimate prize.
I agree. I think it was only in January, actually, the FA announced that they were going to increase the prize money for the FA Cup from next year. They've not said what that will be.
We still don't know, but we are waiting. We wait with bated breath.
Jinx.
But I mean, the only way is up from absolutely nothing that they're paying at the moment. But I think that's obviously been something that has been in the headlines now for quite a long time, because, you know, when you look at the disparity in the FA Cup prize money, I know there's something that we've touched on in previous episodes and I don't want to sort of go back over it again, but it is just absolutely phenomenal that you're in a situation where, you know, 25K to 1.8 mil. I mean, the disparity is just absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, like you were saying, I think the prize pot money is the thing that needs to be increased, because, you know, when you look at the types of teams that are now getting into the FA Cup quarterfinals, you've got Ipswich there, you've got Coventry, and they've already, you know, Ipswich probably don't have the best budget, and Coventry, as we already know, have been in quite dire straits financially for the last year. You know, them going to those games is going to cost them more than they'll actually recover if they drop out at this stage. I think the recovery that they'll only get is about £3,000 or £4,000, and the cost of travel and accommodation and food is going to outweigh anything that they would even get if they won. And, you know, if a team like Man City or Arsenal does win the FA Cup, which they're probably expected to do, they'll be out of pocket for winning the FA Cup because of all the expenses that go with it, because 25K is not going to have covered them for all the games that they would have needed to get there in the first place.
Yeah, I think it's also really important, because I think what's been great about this settlement is the fact that it was very transparent. They were very open about the figures. They were very open about the final kind of solution that they came to. And I think for me, what is frustrating is so many federations have come forward and said, oh, we now have equal pay for our men's and women's team. But actually, when you look kind of at the small print, it's actually, well, it's not equal pay. You've got equal percentages of tournament bonuses, so they're not going to be equal amounts because the tournament prize money is different, or it's equal in other ways. You know, it's like a pay to play bonus or for qualifying bonus. You know, it's never actually equal pay. And I feel like now, because of this incredible thing that the US women's national team have been doing for a number of years, which is building this movement around equal pay, you know, chanting at 2019 World Cup final equal pay, like, what was it, 40,000, 50,000 people. I think now it's like equal pay has become almost like a brand name. Mm-hmm. for people just to throw out and say, oh, it's equal pay. But actually what that means is so different. Like you said, Rachel, like it's got to mean something more. And you were kind of looking at an interesting article where someone was saying, you know, it actually could set
a dangerous precedent.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just shout out to my stepdad. He very kindly sent me this article from NBC. Because my parents now, anytime they see something related to women's football, will screenshot it and send it to me, which is very
sweet. My mum does. She's like, oh, she texts me going, oh, they're talking about equal pay on Women's Hour on Radio 4. I'm like, okay.
I love it. But it was a really interesting point about the precedents it sets, because a lot of this came down to the fact that the women's team were so successful. It almost gave them more of a stand to fight this battle. But that shouldn't be the level that you have to be in order to get equal pay. You shouldn't have to outshine your men's team in order to have equal pay. And I think that's maybe a little bit of the murky area. We shouldn't have to have all of the other national teams outperform their men's teams in order to be able to fight for equal pay. So there is a little bit of a dangerous precedence there, because I think anyone emulating the success of the US women's national team, you know, I'm not sure that's going to happen now with the growth of the women's game. I'm not sure we're ever going to have a team that is
quite...
We have that much of a hold on the World Cup. Exactly. So while, yes, we should be pushing for that equal pay, it shouldn't be based on them performing to some insane level in order to get it.
Yeah, I think it's... I completely agree with you there. And just to sort of jump on the back of what you said is that, you know, you can't have equality based on results. It should just be that is a blanket thing that is provided and provided as a standard. You know, and I don't think you could ever be in a situation, I know with, you know, clubs I've been at previously have been very much of the same kind of ilk, where you say, okay, well, if you finish in the top three, you finish in the top five for this season, then we can then go to the board and ask for X, Y, and Z. And it's like, well, that shouldn't be the case. The board should be providing that anyway. It shouldn't be dependent or contingent upon certain results. That's not how equality works. So, I think that's a really interesting point.
I do think it is hard to compare the US to other nations and other, I guess, continents as well, given they are in quite a unique position where the national team has obviously recently earned more money than the men's, which we've said. So, you know, it's not quite that direct comparison to the WSL or other European leagues. So we asked Rachel Backman what the rest of the world can learn from the US women's past and how they've handled the current situation, because there's definitely plenty we can learn.
The US is singular in its history, right? The women have won 4 World Cups. No other nation has done that. And it has this enormous following in the US and really globally. So in some ways it is unique. In other respects, I think what the US women say that they're fighting for is really for these federations, both nationally and internationally, to live up to their missions. And let's remember that these are nonprofits. These are ostensibly nonprofit organizations that are supposed to fulfill the mission of spreading football throughout the world and growing the game. Well, historically, the women's game has really lagged behind. And part of the reason it's lagged behind is because of a lack of investment of these national and international federations. In some cases, in the case of Britain, for instance, it's because women's football was banned for about half a century. So women are still really playing catch up. It's almost like you have, you know, 2 trees, and one tree was planted, you know, 60 years before the other one, and one was watered every day, and the other one was watered maybe 3 times a year, and people are asking why they're not the same size. You know, I think it's pretty elementary why they're not the same size. So I think part of what the women are saying is, look, we're, you know, yes, we are unique in the world, perhaps, but a lot of these federations really have fallen short of their missions in spreading the game and have largely neglected half the population in doing that. And by the way, if you look at a lot of the growth in terms of viewership and you know, excitement in the game, a lot of that is in women's football. The, you know, the Men's World Cup is a largely mature event. It's massive. It's a huge moneymaker. It's massively popular. Absolutely. Its viewership really hasn't grown significantly in the last 15 or 20 years. While the women's game, partly because it was coming from much farther behind, has grown much, much faster. So if you look at the women's game as sort of a, you know, a startup stock, it makes sense to invest in it now, because it's shown this huge growth potential even without much investment. So it raises the question, well, how much bigger could it get? How much more money could it make for FIFA and for the federations that FIFA represents if it were invested in a bit more, if it's watered a little bit more like that tree?
Some say the US Soccer Federation needs to be more forward-thinking. The current president of the whole organization is an unpaid volunteer. Would you agree that the federation needs to be more modernized?
The current president, and it's an elected position, and you're right, it's unpaid. The current president of U.S. Soccer is a former women's national team player named Cindy Parlow Cohn, and she has another job. She also coaches in a youth league, and it's startling that, you know, one of the largest soccer federations in the world has a leader who has to do this, but that's the reality because she does not make a salary. So I think it's a valid point and a valid concern, and I think it makes sense that there's a proposal on the table to make that a paid position, because if you go decades back, you know, a lot of these sport federations, not just soccer but in other sports and so on, really were run like sort of amateur organizations because all the people they were representing were ostensibly amateurs and so on. But sports has really evolved from them, and you know, Olympic sports, most if not all Olympic athletes, you know, generate some money on the side, either with pro careers or with sponsorships and so on. So, you know, Olympic sport, under which football falls, has really evolved way beyond that amateur model. But I don't think U.S. soccer has kept up. I mean, some years it generates $150 million in revenues. And that's just, you know, that it's just problematic when you have a volunteer leading an organization that size. Sometimes it just seems a little bit nonsensical. You wouldn't hire a volunteer to run a company that generated those revenues every year. So as far as whether there's a model, I don't know if anyone's doing it perfectly. I think this is a challenge for all federations, but it makes some sense to have a leader who is paid, I personally think, just because otherwise you are in a position of either having someone who's time pressed because they have to have another job, or you have, you know, only someone who's independently wealthy can afford the position. And neither one of those seems like an ideal situation.
So what can European federations learn from the US women's experience? How can they improve things like access, fair income for those who are involved in the women's game?
I think, you know, a combination of approaches sometimes works the best. So I think it's fair for women to ask what the FA, for instance, what the FA is investing in women's football and how and why, and whether that, whatever that amount is and whatever those actions are, whether they're appropriate given where women's football is and where, you know, the FA and other people want it to be. I think there is this sort of balance between the national teams and the clubs. And it sounds like my impression of Europe is the European clubs are, fairly quickly starting to invest more in women's football because they also see a potential for revenue. So that's, you know, that's also the good. But, you know, women are, you know, they're trying to grow in a very crowded sports environment. You know, when the Premier League began more than a century ago, I mean, what was previously the Premier League, essentially, the roots of the Premier League started in an era without television, without radio, and certainly no smartphones or, you know, three dozen other sports that people could watch globally. And so the fight that women are making to gain a foothold in the marketplace is much more difficult than the men had. I mean, the men have had, you know, a century to gain a foothold. So I think that the federations, all not just in England but around the world, need to remember that and to think about what they can do to steadily invest and just give women the best chance to succeed. I think people sort of fixate on equality, and I think the US women's team went after that because of their record and because, you know, when you sue, that's sort of what the law says. But I think what federations around the world and women who support women's football should look at is our federation doing everything it can to give women and the women's game the greatest chance to thrive, whatever that means. And, you know, in some sports that means maybe you're half as popular as the men. In some sports, like, for instance, in gymnastics or figure skating, it means you're significantly more popular than the men. You know, the question is, what are you doing to sort of lift the ceiling completely from how big the women's game can be. And I think the U.S. has shown that if you have a very high-achieving women's team, it can become, by several measures, more popular than men. And not that it's a contest, but I think, you know, women have fought very hard and have had some advantages, but have fought very hard to achieve that that place in this country. And they've shown what that kind of fight can produce, which is an enormously popular team.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Have you ever wondered what happened to all those space-age promises that previous generations thought we'd have by now? You know, heading out for the day on your own personal flying cars or working on a space hotel somewhere in the far reaches of our solar system. Where are all those amazing inventions? Well, we're here to find out more on my new podcast, Where's My Jetpack? I'm Sarah Crudis, space expert, TV host and author. Join me and Luke Moore every week as we look into retrofuturistic tech that never was to decide whether it's still just science fiction or if some of these discoveries are actually a lot closer than you think.
I think we're very close to that happening on an even more regular basis. And what I think is interesting about that, too, is that's going to make the accessibility of getting to space available for more and more people.
So, if you've ever wondered whether we'll one day speak to aliens light years away, or you'll be flying to work on a jetpack, this is the podcast for you.
Think of the car parking spaces. They need to be massive, really wide.
No, the wings can fold up.
Well, they don't exist.
No, some of the cars which were designed had wings which folded up.
Are you happy getting in a plane knowing the wings fold up?
Yeah. Right. I trust engineering.
Trust the science.
Search Where's My Jetpack on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Where's My Jetpack is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
We have a final this weekend. It's weird because we had last season's FA Cup final in December. It feels like we've actually kind of been a bit spoiled with big finals.
Yeah, and it's weird when there's like other games on at the same time.
Yeah. And I'm quite excited for a Saturday 5:15 kickoff. I think that's quite nice.
Yeah, I love that. It makes the kind of post-match celebrations a little bit easier to enjoy.
Yeah, I feel like it's not too early, it's not too late, and I also prefer football on Saturday. Sorry guys, I just gotta say I prefer football on Saturday. It's a sacred day for football, so
amen.
I love football on Saturday. And Plough Lane, I've been there a lot. I know a lot of people have been there before, so I'm very excited for people to get a little sight on Plough Lane. I hope the usual food, they've got a really nice thing. This is my little Plough Lane plug. Behind one of the stands, they've got this like whole section of like little food stalls, and it's really nice. It's kind of like a little food market.
Cute.
So I'm really hoping they're going to be open for the game. They've got loads of different things going on, and No, no, wait till you hear this. So obviously AFC Wimbledon are a Phoenix club, so they won't get to the rise for the ashes type thing. Yeah, we won't get into a politics of it, but they've got a pub underneath the stadium.
I heard
called,
that the bowels of the stadium
called the Phoenix, and very it's good. Actually really nice, and they've got loads of craft okay. beers and stuff.
Lovely.
So I'm hoping that will be open too. So great vibes, great times. If you haven't already got a ticket, I don't know if it's sold out, but if it isn't sold out, you should definitely come because I just love Plough Lane and I love Wimbledon, what they're about.
I really hope the cameras picked up Chloe and my eyes when you started going on about the exciting thing you really wanted to tell us, that look we shared.
Yeah, you were rude, actually. You guys rolled
your
eyes.
It's not rude.
It's out of order.
Did you know
and when I'm doing Jager bombs in the Phoenix on Saturday at full time, I'm getting
when
you
When you fall down the stairs
I'm
again,
not getting you
and damage
things.
Your ribs.
Yeah. I'll be fine.
But I just love it because we get one of these generally every pod where you're about to say something wacky and wild and we share these looks and it's lovely.
I'm just a walking, talking trip advisor. but yeah, let's get to back to the football. My food and that drink thing. Plug. But it's a really exciting game because Man City do this thing to me, man. I can't explain it, but it's like every so often I see sparks of, I'm like, Man City are back. This is it. And then they kind of regress a little bit and then they do it again. But it makes it so hard to actually get a sense of how good they are at the moment. And I think you get that sometimes with the WSL because there are some teams that are still a lot stronger than others. But we're seeing that gap kind of narrow a little bit. But for example, before the international break, it took a Caroline Weir worldie to get City past United. FA Cup at the weekend, United take the lead. Katie Zellan was running the show. And City just turn on the heat, become absolutely ruthless and end up winning 4-1 and scoring three goals in what, like 10, 15 minutes. So it's just so hard to get a gauge of when they come up against Chelsea, how good are they going to be? What kind of team are they going to be? Because actually Chelsea this season have kind of shown that, you know, City struggled to make Chelsea really work that hard.
Yeah, I do think with the game at the weekend, that, you know, a lot of that, unfortunately, is Man United's poor second half performance. You know, I think some of the goals were errors and obviously Man City were ruthless. I think when Chelsea turn up to finals, they generally turn up to finals. So I wouldn't expect them, I'm going to go and jinx them, but I wouldn't expect them to be making those kind of errors or to necessarily switch off in the second half. You know, I didn't expect that from United either. But I will say, while City obviously played well, I do think a big factor of that was United kind of switching off in that second half. And I don't expect to see that against Chelsea. Chelsea equally had a pretty ruthless performance at the weekend too that will fill them with confidence. So I think both teams will be going in with lots of confidence and hopefully will make for quite the riveting battle. Hopefully not that kind of...
I hope it's not penalties because I don't want... You remember that Arsenal City Conti Cup? I think it might have been 2018. Was it 2018 or 2019? But that went to a penalty shootout and it was just really boring.
Yeah,
I love a penalty shootout.
Nah, I think there'll be goals. I think there'll be goals. With that team, with the likes of Caroline Weir and the form she's in.
I hope so.
Millie Bright, scoring form.
You know, forward, whack her up there with Harder and Kerr and Kirby and everyone else. And yeah, I think we're in for some goals. And again, hope I don't jinx that because the last time we did some great predictions, it all went down the pan. So
yeah, and I mean, Chelsea's record against City is really good. City haven't beaten Chelsea in 9 meetings. So you would also think that they feel pretty confident because, yeah, like I said, I think they've kind of got their number. I mean, where do you see this one, Chloe? Are you feeling like City will push Chelsea quite hard? Do you think Chelsea are going to ease through?
I'm going to put my, what'd you say, peg in the sand, flag in the sand? What'd you say?
Peg?
Yep. this has gone weird again. Fuck's sake.
Oh,
every,
God, now you're going to be making weird looks at
I'm going to share a look, Flo.
It's not supposed to go like this.
Peg in the sand.
It's just Flo wants to peg someone.
I literally never heard the phrase peg in the sand until today.
No, I'm going to put my flag.
Peg in the sand, flag? Chloe Morgan, 2022. Anyway, carry on, please.
It's been a difficult day as tube strikes.
It's been a long old day.
Come on.
Yeah. Anyway, who are you pegging?
Right, I'm out of it, no joke.
I'm going to say...
Oh dear.
Chelsea. I think Chelsea have got this all day. It's gone to pot in here. I think Chelsea have got this all day. I think the confidence that they've shown, the consistency that they've shown all season is just enough to take them through. Their defensive record is the best in the WSL. Millie Bright, I think, is probably going to put in an absolute banger. She's been consistently on good form and goal-scoring form. So, yeah, I don't think... I think City will put up a good fight, for sure. They're sort of found their feet a little bit, but I still think Chelsea are going to come through and deliver the goods.
I would agree, and I'll probably be made a fool of again. But I think Emma Hayes is a better tactician.
100%.
So when it comes... And in finals particularly. So I think that just gives the team an extra layer. But I do think we're going to see goals. I really want to see goals. And last time we said that about Arsenal-Chelsea and it was a bloody 0-0 draw. So if I don't see goals, I'm walking out.
Yeah, there are still question marks as well about Chelsea's squad coming back from the international break, fitness-wise. We know, obviously, Steph Horton is undergoing surgery for an Achilles injury, which isn't great for City. But I think they still have a fairly, you know, strong squad at the moment. Lauren Hemp, Caroline Wynn, sensational form. But Chelsea still have a few absentees and feels like their squad have worked particularly hard during the international break, especially the ones that went away with England. You'll be going to the Conti Cup final.
I will.
At Pal Lane in the Phoenix.
I love the fact that it's on a Saturday. I can't just go see a game.
And then where are you on Sunday?
We have Coventry at home, yeah, which will be interesting. So it'll be the first time I've obviously played them since all the hoo-ha went down over Christmas. But it should be an interesting game. We're picking up some points. Looking to end the league on a strong note. So it's a game that we're expecting to get some points out of.
Love it. And where are you Sunday, Rachel?
Sunday, I will be Reading Spurs and Sophie will be coming down to your game.
Lovely.
Yeah.
We'll see you there.
Yeah.
Love that.
Put in a good performance, she might talk to you afterwards.
Brilliant.
I've got two Arsenal games this week. I'm at Bournemouth on Wednesday night and I'm at Bournemouth on Sunday. So, there we go. A lot of Arsenal, but what a week. See you at the Conti Cup final, lads. That is all we've got time for on today's episode of Upfront on Football Ramble Presents. Thanks a lot to Rachel Backman for giving us her time. And also, yeah, we hope you enjoyed that chat about contracts and we're definitely going to get back into that as well at another stage with Chloe's lawyer hat always firmly on. If you've got any questions as well, tweet us at Football Ramble, at Floyd Tweet, at Girls on the Ball, or at Morgie_89, and we'll see you all next week.
Upfront is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia, movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
and Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman, I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.